Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On today's program, we look back at the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement with our guest, General Baker.
During the 67 Rebellion, I think our greatest lesson we learned during that, when the rebellion started in 67 in the U.S. Army, 101st Airborne occupied the west side of the city, the east side of the city, and the National Guard and state police occupied the east side. And when they declared martial law in town, if a child got sick, you couldn't go to the hospital. If you got hungry, didn't have food, you couldn't go. But if you had a badge from Dodge or Chrysler, Ford, or GM, you'd get through all the police lines, all the army lines, and go to work. And that's one of the real lessons we learned, where the only place we had any real value in society was at the point of production. And that's why we took up the challenge to try to organize there at that point, because you had no other value, no place else. So we learned that lesson from a real practical experience during the rebellion in 67. And so, the Dodge Revolutionary Union followed right on the heels of that in 1968.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper, People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. February is Black History Month, and part of that history is the creation of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, who helped lead the Wildcat auto strikes in Detroit during the 1960s. Today, our guest is General Baker, a man who was intimately involved in the creation of those organizations and who also was the first American to burn his draft card and refuse induction into the military during the Vietnam War. This interview was originally recorded on KVMR FM radio in California shortly after the release of the book Detroit, Yes, I Do Mind Dying, in August of 1998. And joining us on the line today, I am very pleased to have General Baker with us. Some of you may know that South End Press has released the book Detroit, Yes, I Do Mind Dying, and that is a story of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. We have with us General Baker, a man who is an integral part of that history. Jen, thanks for being with us on the program today.
And Mike, thank you. It's really my pleasure.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you with us today. Can you talk about the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers and that period of America's history?
I certainly can. Mike, let me first of all say that the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, or DRUM, was formed about 30 years ago. Matter of fact, this is the 30th anniversary of its founding. And it was founded at the Hamtramck Assembly Plant of Chrysler Corporation that produced the Dodge cars. And that's why it was called Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, because it really actually grew out of the plant where the Dodges, the big Hemis and Chargers, were being built back in that day. It was basically an organization that was trying to address the plight that black workers found themselves facing in the auto industry. You know, the discriminatory practices of the past, the fact that you couldn't really get a redress of grievances, that we had difficulties both with the union and the company on both sides, you know, trying to press for the struggle for equality. And what happened was basically that after coming through a period of the Civil Rights Movement in the early 60s, and you'd won, actually passed the Civil Rights Act, and we'd won everything in a sense, and in fact won nothing, because the conditions at the plant remained the same. So these are the kind of desirous things that forced us to try to organize. DRUM actually grew out of a series of kind of wildcat strikes. They weren't called by black workers, but was called by workers in general. But every time the strike was over and people were brought into discipline, black workers received the brunt of the discipline. And these are the kind of conditions that led to a group of us getting together and deciding, well, we got to do something. We got to fight back. And out of this whole movement grew DRUM. DRUM actually existed by just putting out a little communication newsletter once a week at the plant. The Hamtramck assembly plant, should point out to you, was the largest assembly plant that Chrysler had. It had 10,000 employees. It was a massive old facility where you ran seven stories high. So you had to, and the communication gap was really wide. You had to really struggle to let people on one end of the planet know what's going on in the other. And in that sense, a newsletter format was formed that helped us to try to communicate and unite people around the single issues inside the shop. So that's the conditions that it was born under. And that was prior to actually having any really legal route to go on the fight for discrimination. You know, even though the Civil Rights Act was passed in 64 and then again in 66, it didn't really mean anything until you got a Supreme Court decision back in 71. So for a whole period of time where the law is passed before it's tested in the Supreme Court, you got no relief that coming that way. So we just had to battle things out and try to struggle to get some relief without any kind of compensation. All we got was basically a bunch of discharges, a bunch of people fired, because that's all the rights we had. But the struggle was so intense we had no other choice.
This is also at a time where the U.S. Army and other military forces were actually occupying parts of Detroit, correct?
Certainly, during the 67 rebellion, when I think our greatest lesson we learned during that, when the rebellion started in 67 in the U.S. Army, 101st Airborne occupied the west side of the city, the east side of the city, and the National Guard and state police occupied the east side. And when they declared martial law in town, if a child got sick, you couldn't go to the hospital. If you got hungry, didn't have food, you couldn't go. But if you had a badge from Dodge or Chrysler, Ford, or GM, you'd get through all the police lines, all the army lines to go to work. And that's one of the real lessons we learned, where the only place we had any real value in society was at the point of production. And that's why we took up the challenge to try to organize there at that point, because you had no other value, no place else. So we learned that lesson from a real practical experience during the rebellion in 67. And so, you know, the Dodge Revolutionary Union followed right on the heels of that in 1968.
Talk, if you will, about, you made that statement that we learned very quickly that the only place we had any real worth was at the point of production. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure, certainly. The ability to work, in the 60s, you got to remember, that was before the massive plant closings and stuff. We had a real concentration of minority workers at the point of production. Detroit City was a city, when they called it the auto capital, they weren't kidding. At that time, Chrysler had 29 plants in the city of Detroit, GM about 16, Ford about 10. So we had a real concentration of auto work in the hot, heavy departments, in the body shops and paint shops and foundries, a real concentration of minority workers. And there, that's the only place in society you were needed. You were needed there at the point of production to produce the profit that the auto industry needed in order to survive. And that's what we meant by that the only real value we had in society was at the point of production. They didn't need you sitting at home doing nothing. They didn't need you to care whether or not you ate or your health was good. They needed you at the point of production, and that's the only place you had value. And, you know, that we translated that into a place that we need to organize here, and not at the parks on the weekend and people getting together talking stuff and militant on the weekend and doing anything during the week. We had to try to develop a movement Monday through Friday, and that's kind of what led us in that direction.
We're talking with General Baker about the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Jen, talk about the League of Revolutionary Black Workers.
Sure. The League of Revolutionary Black Workers grew out of the drum movement. You know, once we had a big strike at the Dodge main plant in July of 1968, and from that strike, the movement grew to all the plants around the cities. We had movements called LRUM, FROM, UPRUM, MACRUM, JRUM, all the Jefferson Assembly, MAC Assembly, every plant in the city almost adopted the same format and created little RUM groups in these various places. And as we carried that struggle on, it became necessary to amalgamate these groupings, you know, into one entity. And it's in that sense that the League of Revolutionaries, League of Black Revolutionary Black Workers was formed. We also had student components of kids in the high schools that organized in the same way, and some community organizations that came in with us. So it became a big umbrella group that was basically fighting out at the point of production as opposed to other places in society. So that became the format for League of Revolutionary Black Workers back in the 60s. I wanted to point out, though, Mike, you know, that obviously a lot of things have changed from then to now. Like I said, I think the most important thing was plants were stable back then. You know, that was before the era of plant closings. So in order to get rid of a group inside of a plant, the whole plant would have to be closed. It was really odd at that period of time. You know, so a lot of stability in the movement in terms of organizing at the point of production that we don't find today. And it was real instructive lessons for us coming out of that period.
Well, certainly, and I'd like to get to talking about how all of this goes together in a larger context.
Sure.
But it's interesting, you know, you were saying on some level, you know, things have changed, but I'm thinking of a picture that I'm looking at in my office that Damon Hartley sent me from Detroit. looked to me like the cops were just beating the heck out of strikers not too long ago. Just like they were doing in Detroit back then, right?
Certainly, and a lot of that's still in place. I mean, the terror on the strike line is still just as intense as it was, today as it was back then. Even worse so, because unions and things have lost some of the clout that they used to have politically. So a whole lot of that still exists, you know, in terms of that terror. We had a situation, you know, with the Flint strike up in Michigan, up in, you know, just 90 miles above us, where we had a lot of police harassment on the strike lines just a few weeks ago. A demonstration we had the other day around some healthcare clothes. We were almost terrorized by the police on the line. So the kind of police and state terror that exists then still exists today. And we're really, really confronted with that. It's an issue we're going to obviously take up. Every time you make a move to improve your condition of life, you're confronted with the agents of the state, mainly the police departments at first, you know, trying to intimidate you and cow you back into the same old status quo.
Talk, if you will, you said that you were almost terrorized on the strike line just the other day.
Yeah.
Talk about that, if you will.
Sure. We had a demonstration at a healthcare facility that's owned by Henry Ford Hospital here in the city, and we had a demonstration. It was really an informational picket line. It had about 100 people that came out just to popularize the fact that Henry Ford is closing down a series of about 3 clinics that serve a great section of people in healthcare. And we get to the picket line, and we get there, and the police are standing here with their bootstraps on, with their handcuffs in their hand, just intimidating the pickers as they walked around. They threatened us all the way. We had to have a lawyer intervene just in order to walk around. When we got ready to leave and disperse, they actually moved behind people in the parking lot, just harassing and forcing them to go ahead and get on the cars. It was no actually striking any blows, but just a general attitude on a peaceful picket line like that is just absurd. We picketed for about an hour's time, and we're confronted like that by the police department, which is a thing that really got to be challenged. We've got to deal with.
Talk about how we can go about challenging that, because what I'm hearing you say is that if we really want to analyze the function of the police, their function is to act as agents of repression and oppression when working people try to make some sort of move to improve their lot in life.
Certainly. Mike, you know, one of the things that had to be done, I think it's kind of education that we had coming out of the 60s that people are going to be re-educated about, is the real role of the police in the state, that they are there not to protect your interests, but to protect the interests of private property and that alone. And oftentimes people misplace that lesson, or you may learn it in this period and forget about it in the next period. But the newspaper strikers that over the last few years we had outright tear gassing and terror imposed upon them. I mean, the examples from all over the country, every time we strike, we're confronted by these police that you hope will come up there being neutral, but actually they join the side of the companies and protect private property and will do anything they can to try to intimidate you. And this is even over and above the private security people that's being employed by corporations now as stormtroopers. But the police back them all the way, and so we got a real learning lesson to understand what is the role of police in society. They're not there to protect your interests, but to protect the interests of private property.
We're talking with General Baker about the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and what all of that means today.
Yeah.
In America. Jim, let me ask you, because you bring up a really interesting point, and if we look back at history here in the United States, and in particular focusing on labor history, we see these same repeating patterns that, you know, workers are abused and mistreated, and then they try to fight back, and they make a few gains, and then they're sort of beaten back. And why is it that the American public seems to forget this over and over?
Well, you know, I think two reasons. First of all, the lessons aren't shared in a general broad frame that they need to be. And even though some of them are picked up by the media, people have a tendency to really forget. I guess we're faced with this whole situation where each generation wants to try to relearn this lesson without looking at the historical lessons. And the degree that the historical lessons are not passed over, people actually feel like they got to relearn the lesson themselves, and we caught in this thing over and over again. We have had, there was a lot of experience that came out of the labor movement in the 30s, fighting against these police and the picketed agents and learning lessons out of that. There were a lot of lessons that came out of the civil rights movement of the 60s. But generally across the board, except for these labor battles and some of these civil rights struggles, these lessons aren't totally known. I remember when we started taking up the poverty issues and fighting, trying to build tent cities around the city here in Detroit in the early 90s, the police would come every day and tear down the tent. And just to take the tent down, they didn't want the existence of a tent standing there facing people that could be a rallying center. And these lessons just keep being lost. We've got to figure out a way to develop a line of theory that could be transferred across generations to really understand the role of police that they play in society. And we got to be able to take all that into account as we enter battle. One of the other difficulties we got, Mike, in the current period of time, is it hasn't been a lot of massive mobilizations like we had in past periods, which denies people actual learning experiences. You know, like if you went back to the 30s where you had the massive fights around the Depression and the war effort against the fascists during World War II, and then you go to the 60s with the struggle against the Vietnam War and the civil rights stuff, you had a lot of massive mobilization taking place where you could see these lessons thrown back in your face day by day, and therefore it became a real learning experience where you could hold on better. Today, where you see a few mobilizations, only a few demonstrations, you see the police beating young kids' heads for the most part, and you just see them as an instrument attacking gangs. But believe me, anybody that gathers to struggle for their own right becomes a gang in the eyes of the police, and you'll be confronted with the same kind of conditions. So we got to figure out a way to really actually transfer that learning experience and develop it as a theory of what we got to take into account as we begin to fight back.
Which is a big reason, I would imagine, why you're involved in the League of Revolutionaries for a New America.
Definitely. We got to have a theoretical understanding of what we're fighting. And, our whole experience has been fighting back. I couldn't even, until you start developing the study of theory and looking at the theory and the unfolding class struggle, I couldn't really even explain some of the stuff I was involved in to the 60s until I had a theory to look back at it. You know, it just seemed to be a lot of scattered and in place unconnected kind of events. But when you look back at a theory, you know, in terms of unfolding class struggle, then you begin to really see some real lessons. And I think that's the real importance of today's struggle, is the fact that we got to the developing class consciousness that we got to fight for to see us fighting back as a class. And it's class is almost a bad word in American society. Nobody wants to talk about class. You want to talk about ethnicity and other little issues, but economic class alignment is a critical question that we got to deal with, and that's where we can find out who our friends and who our enemies based on which class we belong to.
Certainly a lot of the exploited and implanted racism in America has been used to help blind people who find themselves in a similar class to the commonality that they have with each other. I mean, it's worked pretty well for a long time, hasn't it?
It's worked for 400 years in terms of dividing the class. And, you know, plus with the other old individualism that's always touted so greatly here in America, is that the old cowboy image that I can get what I need by myself, I don't need no help, you know, is a real drawback. So you take the ethnic lineup and the old a cowboy image, a He-Man image, and you get these ideologies that really conflict with the understanding of class. Obviously, the only way we're going to be victorious is understanding that we mobilize all that's affected by the current crisis we're confronted with, and draw them into struggle in the broadest framework. That's the only way we're going to be really big victorious, which is a tremendous job, and that's really the task of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. We set about our task as spreading the theory, inspiring the American people to the fact that we can win this struggle, that we got for one time in history the ability to have quite an abundance where nobody has to live in poverty, and to try to get these lessons over to people in a real way so they can point out who the enemy is and we can direct our fight in a real way. That's the kind of task we got kind of in front of us now. That's a real challenge, and really fortunate for us to be living in a period of time like this where we can actually point to new hope that couldn't have been pointed to in past periods.
I know that you have been out and continuing your involvement as an educator and an organizer. You just recently spoke at the Black Radical Congress in Chicago, is that correct?
Yeah, certainly, back in June.
Can you talk a little bit about that event?
Yeah, sure. I think the event, the opening was quite an event. We had an attendance of about 2,000 people. I think that shocked most of the organizers. They didn't realize there was going to be quite that big of a turnout for the call that went out. And I think over half of those participants were young people, which was really important. And the a couple of the open plenaries, I think, were helpful in terms of having a dialogue between veterans or older people and talking with youth was real helpful, a real helpful exchange. And since that time, I think, even though I don't think much will come out of the way the conclusion of the Black Radical Congress was, they came up with an organizational structure but couldn't unite on a program of march. So it's still going to leave things quite a bit scattered, but it shows that there's a lot of people out there looking for a direction, trying to find their way. And unless we can stand up, you know, and talk about a line of march and talk about a direction that we can fight in, you know, these people will still be lost and blinded out here fighting for a direction. They're not going to find it other places except in our ability to try to transfer some of the theoretical experiences that we've learned from history and gathered into a package and a program of understanding that we embody within the League of Revolutionaries for a New America.
We're talking with General Baker about the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, and what all of that means in a political and social and class context here in America and throughout the world. Jen, you brought up the issue of connecting with youth and bringing youth into the struggle, or at least helping them to become more part of the struggle. I mean, it's really important. I mean, older legs get tired.
They certainly do.
Yes, they do. And can you talk about what we need to do to really engage youth so they can be a part of the ongoing struggle?
Well, certainly. I think two things are necessary. First of all, we got to recognize that I think that youth are fighting back, and they're finding forms to carry out their struggle in the current period. And I think we got to first of all appreciate those and try to struggle to find those. And whether they take a cultural form or whatever form they take, I think it's the duty of kind of veterans to look to respect those forms, and so therefore we can approach youth on an equal basis. Say, listen, let me try to explain some of the historical experiences I had, and let me learn from yours. So in kind of an exchange like that, I think it's real helpful. I think if we just approach it to say that youth aren't doing anything, I think it would be a real wrong way to approach it and a real setback. So I think, first of all, we've got to appreciate the kind of struggles they're carrying out and then try to figure out a way to try to lend some historical experience and assistance and try to get them a legacy of theory. I think one of the most important things that came out of the Black Radical Congress was the comments that another veteran, Nelson Perry, had made at that open plenary, where he stated that one of the big differences between his generation coming out of the 30s and our generation now was the fact that they had witnessed all of this mobilization of people around, fighting around a depression and hunger marches. They'd witnessed the battle around World War II and developing mass movements against fascism. And they had seen a lot of that. They had been active in a lot of that, and therefore they were more ripe for theory. They needed a theoretical direction. You know, you come to this period where you got a lack of a lot of mobilizations, and so you confront it with a situation where you got to do both things: either both mobilize people and learn from that, and then try to figure out how to impose a theory on it. So I think that's a real important kind of observation in terms of our task today: trying to figure out how to find the struggle where it is, no matter how much in its infancy it might be, and to try to provide some kind of a leadership to that off of past experience and study so we can develop a theory and develop a line of march that can get us through this difficult period so we don't make some of the same old mistakes that have been made in the past. So I think, Mike, that's kind of the direction we got to go in this period of time. And it's real difficult. I know that that some of the experiences that we had in back in the 60s, and obviously you can't use copycat tactics, because so many things have changed. Back in that period of time, it was before the speculative capitalists had the upper hand, and, you know, plants were stable. Now they're closed. I noticed just in yesterday's Wall Street Journal about General Motors is going to sell off 200,000 employees and 208 plants at Delphi. So they're gonna separate and send break off a section of the whole plant, which means that obviously having stability in workplace settings like that is not going to be the same as it used to be. But at the same time, people have to eat and people have to survive, and we got to find those places where they're battling back to try to imbue that with a theory and understanding of class struggle and who the real enemy is and how we can develop a line of march that can be victorious.
Jen, we just have a couple of minutes left.
Sure.
Are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave with our audience about this history we've spoke about and where we are today?
I certainly would. I just think that, first of all, it's a real pleasure to be able to address the audience. I think it could never be a better time to address it now with the current crisis that we're confronted with. We have the ability as a society, with the development of new technology, to free people up from all kind of back-breaking work and to provide all kind of goods and necessities of life for people that never existed before. If we can just get across the basic understanding that the technology that's replaced us in the workplace has also increased the productivity to the degree that a lot of people shouldn't ever have to work again, and the fact that we can build houses overnight on assembly lines, that we can get that we can have health care free for everybody, and the possibilities of having this is here at hand. It's just that the handful of billionaires that control it all keep all the profit for themselves and deny the overwhelming mass of people in the United States from sharing in that. And I think if we can just get across that basic understanding of what's possible, if we unite and struggle to take care and take over of the technology and the developments in the society, it's basically the fruits of our labor, that we can live a wonderful life that we've only dreamed about in the past, even though it'll be a battle. So I think if we could just get that little point across, it might seem like a little thing, but it's such a great thing and such an advance in human history that never existed before that offers us some golden opportunities that wasn't here before. Mike, if we can get those things across, I think that we've done well at taking a great step forward in terms of doing our job.
General Baker, thank you for being with us on the program to talk about the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, and what's happening in our society today.
Okay. Thank you, Mike.
That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. PTR is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. Lerna advocates for a cooperative society where the same technologies that are displacing workers around the world are used to create a world of abundance for all. In addition to People's Tribune Radio, Lerna also publishes the newspapers People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo, as well as other printed and audio material like Moving Onward, From Racial Division to Class Unity, and Long Roads and Revolution, a conversation between Utah Phillips and Nelson Peary. Many of the guests on People's Tribune Radio, like General Baker, are available for speaking engagements on college campuses and at other venues. If you'd like more information about Lerna, its newspapers, its publications, or its speakers bureau, contact us at 1-800-691-6888. That number once again, 1-800-691-6888. I'm Mike Thornton. On behalf of General Baker and the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.